Welcome back to the Educated Patient Podcast, where conversations create confidence. I'm your host, Mike DeMarco, and today we're joined by Dr. Alperin. Dr. Alperin is an internal medicine and obesity medicine specialist at Forward Focus Concierge Medicine in Highland Park, Illinois. Dr. Alperin is passionate about helping patients treat obesity through personalized, compassionate, and science-based care that addresses the whole person. Today, we'll be discussing the evolving landscape of obesity treatment, how to overcome stigmas, and practical ways to build long-term health. Dr. Alperin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
I'm very excited about this conversation today. There's so much to unpack specifically with obesity, but also just in terms of the way that care has evolved for this condition and the stigmas, and there's a lot of threads to pull on in the conversation today. But before we get there, I'd love to hear a little context of your professional journey to this point in time, how you landed with this practice. Offline, we were discussing how this is a newer practice for you. So I'd love to hear your background and how you chose obesity medicine and care.
Absolutely. So I am an internist and a primary care doctor through and through. When I started seeing patients in primary care about 11 years ago, I fell in love with preventative medicine. What can I do as a physician? What can I teach and empower my patients to do to prevent problems and not just diagnose and treat? And when I looked at the most common diseases that we were treating, metabolic disease was largely the most common, right? High blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, cardiovascular disease. And seeing patients year after year, I could tell that we weren't getting any healthier. And looking at the underlying thread, it was pretty easy to see that people are gaining weight as we get older. So I became more curious about weight management, the pathophysiology, what happens as we get older, why. And I felt really not well trained in medical weight management and in obesity care. So I started to explore how to get more training and how to be able to help my patients, because truly I felt that weight gain was the umbrella overlying problem causing a lot of the metabolic disease that I was seeing. And I discovered the Obesity Medicine Association and the training and the resources that they provided. And I became board certified in obesity medicine. That really shifted and my, or, you know, provided me the understanding of obesity as a chronic disease and really empowered me with tools to help my patients. So in addition to treating patients for primary care, I developed a medical weight management part of my practice where I saw patients who had other primary care doctors, but saw me as a consultant for medical weight management, where I got to create an individualized plan and see patients in follow-up to hopefully see progress. And it's incredible how much better people feel, how disease improves in real time, and how grateful people are when you validate obesity as a disease and provide actionable plans that really work. So that is how I got here. I very recently, as you mentioned earlier, about 4 months ago, switched from a large healthcare system and joined a small concierge private practice called Forward Focus. The big reason for that is medical weight management is very complex, and so is primary care. And in our large healthcare systems, I have felt it's increasingly more difficult to provide the personalized, attentive, accessible care that my patients deserve. And I wanted more time at the bedside. I wanted to listen and hear the whole patient's story and not be rushed or not feel that my time is paid for by insurance companies, and therefore switch to a concierge model of care. How that has changed my practice is I'm able to decrease the total number of patients I see by, a third. And that allows me to not only spend more time with my patients, but also be accessible when patients struggle and they have acute problems. In concierge medicine, I also see patients, my own patients, when they're admitted to the hospital. And I partner with the hospitalists to really provide holistic care and a connected care from the outpatient to the inpatient world. So this type of practice allows me to really feel like I'm deeply contributing to my patients, not just during health and wellness, but also during illness. And it really helps in people feeling like they are really well taken care of.
You mentioned a few things in there around you really feeling a pull and a desire to spend more time with each of your patients, which is one of the reasons that led you to transitioning into a different type of practice. I'm curious from your experience, like beyond just the medical condition, what are the variables that an obese patient is navigating? Beyond just the medical side, because I know for a fact that there's social variables, there's environmental variables, there's the medical right? So like what in your head,
Absolutely.
what are those variables that you're working with patients on?
Absolutely. So patients with obesity have usually struggled with extra weight since childhood. All right. We often find that helpful aunt or uncle who every Thanksgiving points out that, my patient gained a couple pounds, and this really creates a cycle of guilt, shame, and I take the time to unpack that. On top of that, unfortunately, our society and even in the healthcare system, there is still a lot of bias towards patients struggling with weight. It has been perceived in the past, and I certainly am hopeful that some of these biases are changing, but it has been perceived in the past that patients that struggle with extra weight are unmotivated or lazy, or they eat too much, or they eat the wrong thing. And it couldn't be more of the opposite in the real world and in practice. Patients that I work with who struggle with obesity are some of the most motivated people that I meet. They really have tried their whole life and they've done impossible to try to lose weight. So I take the time to teach them that obesity is a chronic disease and it starts in your genetic code. It also starts actually in your environment inside your mother's womb. And foods that your mom ate, and hormones or chemicals your mom was exposed. And in addition to genetics and environment, we also are living in a society where our food system is largely broken, right? And it's difficult to afford healthy food. And even the healthy food, unfortunately, is just not as healthful nutrient-wise as it was many years ago. So we unpack a lot of that. And of course, I take the time to get to know person's lifestyle. What are their sleep habits? What is their exercise routine? Do they have an exercise routine, or have they been suffering with joint pain that they were maybe too embarrassed to bring up to their doctor in the past because they've heard all too many times, oh, if you only lose a couple pounds, your joint pain would get better. So I take the time to teach my patients that obesity is a disease that is multifactorial, and they unfortunately have very little to do with it. But I do empower them with the tools, and the current treatment landscape is so much better than it was even 15 years ago that once I break through the shame and the guilt and partner with my patients, we are almost always successful in helping people lose weight and feel better.
That last piece, partnering with your patients, I think is crucial, especially when you're dealing with a patient that's navigating a condition that is so intertwined with their mindset and the things that are that they've been carrying inside of their head for years and years and years.
Absolutely.
I'm curious, what are some exact tactical ways that you help somebody, maybe when they first start coming to your clinic, start to remold their thinking or their mind around the condition so that you can help them understand like it this isn't purely a willpower or lack thereof condition. There's other aspects to this that you're going to be partnering with them on.
Absolutely. So I do a lot of teaching on the pathophysiology of obesity. And we talk about how does our body control our weight? And it's a very complex process in our body, but we have a long discussion about hormones. The hormones largely control our weight. And it is a very intricate interplay between the gut hormones and the brain hormones and their connection in weight management in our body. We talk about how certain people have hunger hormones that are much higher than in other people. And certainly, if your brain is designed and built such that you are constantly hungry, you can try all you want to minimize food intake, but your physiology often overtakes and people end up overeating if you have excess hunger. Other people struggle with a hormone milieu where they are never full. Sometimes we call that poor satiety, meaning they eat a portion of food that they think is normal for their size or a portion of food that their friends or family eat, but they don't feel full at that portion because their body and their hormones are built such that they have poor satiety, and that can result in overeating. There's other people that have a brain hormone milieu that they crave things. And it sometimes is food, and certainly that's more relevant in my practice, but sometimes it's alcohol, sometimes it's any other kind of addictive substance. But we all know that certain patients are more prone to craving and addiction. It can run in families too. So I take a long time to discuss with patients that it is not that your hormones and your physiology is what controls our behavior, not vice versa. But we do have some excellent tools to help control the underlying physiology that then results into behavior, which can lead to weight loss. And when people hear that, they, one, again, that shame and guilt subsides, right? And they feel empowered that in addition to lifestyle changes, we might need medication to help control the physiologic dysfunction that resulted in extra weight. And that's okay, right? Just like any other disease, we treat patients with obesity with lifestyle plus medication plus or minus surgery in the right person.
Obviously, this is where I asked the question around GLP-1s as a tool. How you mentioned the treatment landscape being significantly better than it was 15 years ago, but what are some tools? The GLP-1s are the obvious one, right? For most people, everyone listening to this has heard that term before, but what are some other tools in addition to those that can help with the underlying physiology that then help you drive the behavior and the lifestyle change that people feel most shameful about not doing?
Absolutely. So I'm going to mention lifestyle first because that is an underlying pillar for treatment of weight management always. And I empower patients. I use that word empower a lot because I think it's really important, right? Again, we're partnering with our patients. There are very real lifestyle changes we can do to help with hormones. The first thing I talk about is sleep. We know that in patients that have an adequate number, total number of hours of sleep, or in patients that work shift work, or in patients that have an underlying sleep disorder, their hunger hormones are through the roof and people end up gaining weight. So we talk about sleep as one of our cardinal priorities in changing our lifestyle to impact hormones. Okay. We talk about nutrition as the next pillar, right? And I'm not saying sleep is more important than nutrition. We kind of talk about it all. But we know that people that eat a diet low in protein and low in healthy fats, and a diet focused on processed foods or largely carbohydrate, are hungrier. We know that satiety and fullness really comes from eating adequate amounts of protein and healthy fat. And I tweak and modify people's eating to help with the hormones that help with satiety. So those are some examples of very actionable lifestyle changes that patients can make to really impact their hormones. Okay. We certainly talk about medication, and you are right. The GLP-1s are the medicines that have been in the news nonstop, multiple times a day, right? There is a new article about the good, the bad. And it's wonderful that we have GLP-1s to help treat patients with obesity. They have really revolutionized treatment because they're really the only drug that tackles the gut hormones that help with satiety. So my patients that are never full, those are really the drugs that I reach for because GLP-1s slow down digestion and make people feel fuller much, much quicker. They also help with maintaining fullness for longer. However, practicing medical weight management and obesity care before the GLP-1 craze, I will say, I've known treatments for obesity that are non-GLP-1s that have been around for decades. These medicines, I'll mention a couple. There's a combination of phentermine topiramate or another combination of bupropion naltrexone. These have been around for a long time. We know that they're safe for the right person. These medications target more of the brain hormone chemistry. So for some of my patients that have excess hunger or some of my patients that have a lot of cravings and emotional overeating, I might choose one of those medicines. When we look at efficacy, the GLP-1s are the most effective for weight loss when looking at percent fat loss, percent body mass change. However, like every chronic disease, obesity medicine is not one size fit all.
So there's a lot in there around lifestyle. I want to park the car for a second and talk specifically around nutritional strategies without making broad recommendations that everybody should try this specific diet. What are some of the most successful strategies that you've been able to put into practice for different types of patients?
Great question. So, successful diets are really individualized. It is the most successful diet is the one that you're going to be able to maintain for the rest of your life. This is when I talk to patients about fad diets and whether a low fat or low carb or a calorie restricted diet or intermittent fasting. We get all these questions, right? Which one is best for me? And I pause and I say, the best diet is the one that is going to be sustainable for you, right? Now, there are some specific guidelines that I give to all patients depending on their current weight. We do want adequate protein intake because protein is really the building block for muscle. Muscle is what allows us to maintain and sometimes improve our metabolic rate. And we all require adequate amounts of protein, especially during active weight loss. So that type of guidance I give, I individualize per patient, but that is, and the rest, to be honest, is I tailor it to the patient. I go through meticulously and talk to each person about what do you eat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner? What kind of snacks do you have? What time are you done eating in the evening? And we tailor their nutrition and their eating patterns to make them a little bit better, right? We all could use some tips and helpful recommendations to improve our diet. And the reason I do this is when we look at data and we look at low fat versus low carb diets, they really are about the same. There is some data that people that eat a lower carbohydrate diet are able to maintain that diet longer because a low fat diet tends to leave people hungrier. And people on a lower carbohydrate diet are not as hungry and maybe can maintain that diet for longer. But we have yet to find the best diet for weight loss. Therefore, I really stick with a personalized approach where I have very concrete protein goals, fiber, very, very important for both fullness and GI gut health. Otherwise, I tailor it to the patient with a focus on whole foods, the least processed possible, and what works with their lifestyle, right? So that's been my approach to nutrition for my patients.
Great. So we've talked about mindset. We've talked about nutrition. We've talked about the tools and medicines that could coincide with the lifestyle change. I'm a fitness guy, so I would love to transition into the co transition and fill out that fourth pillar that I think is also crucial here, which is movement and getting people moving. We mentioned a little bit earlier, but I'd love to just pivot the conversation there and hear your thoughts on when you see it coming into the fold in your care for patients, if it's right out the gate or if you like to get to a certain point in time and how that fits into your practice.
Great question. So seeing patients who struggle with weight is complex, right? We just talked about so many things we have to cover. Certainly, their movement routine is another very important part of the picture, right? I will say I usually prioritize discussion about exercise second or third to sleep and nutrition, because to me, those are just such big priorities, right? If someone does not sleep well, they ain't going to be able to move their body. It's really hard. They're persistently exhausted, right? If they are constantly hungry or never full and they're not getting enough protein in, it's going to be really hard to ask them to do resistance training. So those are my two primary focuses. However, I certainly plant the seed early that we're going to be talking about movement. There is also some data that shows that for weight loss, exercise is not as important as sleep and nutrition. However, for weight loss maintenance, so maintaining a healthier weight, exercise begins to be tremendously important, right? So once I get to exercise, which I try to right away, but sometimes again, we prioritize things depending on the person. I meet people where they are when it comes to exercise. People come in all different mindsets when it comes to moving their body, right? So again, without eliciting, God forbid, any guilt or shame, I ask people what they like to do to move. What kind of work do they do? Does their work, or do they sit at work all the time? Or do they work on the third floor and take the stairs? So we take the time to figure out what is the person's movement strategy. Then I pause and I say, well, is anything in your body restricting movement for you? Do you feel short of breath when you're climbing stairs? Do you have joint pain? Are your knees really bothering you and you can't walk a block? So we take a pause on that. And sometimes if I hear a lot of those things, I pause on advice for movement and I tackle those things first, right? So for someone that has a lot of knee pain, I might say, all right, well, let's talk about this. Let's figure out why you're having knee pain. Right? Do we have an arthritic condition we need to manage? Do we have gout? Who knows, right? If someone feels short of breath when they're climbing stairs, I might pause and say, oh boy, do we have a heart condition that's sort of underlying this? So I meet people where they are. I discuss what they're doing now in terms of their movement and what are their barriers for movement. And we devise a personalized approach. We know that 120 minutes of exercise is the recommendation. However, that looks different for every person, right? And for someone that hasn't moved their body in a decade, that advice falls on deaf ears. So I meet them where they are and we start slow. I'm a big believer that if you give people a very small goal that's not just attainable, but a goal that they might beat, really empowers people to then move on and do more. So an example of that would be, hey, when you're showering, can you do three squats every day? And people will look at me and say, three squats? Like, are you kidding? That's it? And I say, yeah. But when they come back to see me for a follow-up visit and I ask them how their squats are going, half the time they said, oh, I do 10 squats in the shower every day based on our conversation. I say, wow. Not only are you meeting our goals that we have set for each other, but you're exceeding our expectations. And that really helps people to be like, wow, this is, I'm an overachiever here. I can do more. So small, really small, attainable goals tailored to the patient's body, to their ability, and constantly working to boost people up, to encourage them to see their progress and to motivate them going further.
I love that. It's amazing how complicated we make progress and achievement, right? Everyone thinks they need these big, elaborate complex goals when in reality we're all human beings and all our brain needs is a little hit of achievement, and then it starts to think it could do a lot more, and you just stack that over time and eventually, you're moving and having momentum in the direction you want to go.
That's right. The one thing I haven't yet mentioned, which deserves attention, is working in a multidisciplinary team, right? So I do work with a dietitian. I do have physical therapists or exercise physiologists that I work with and lean on those experts to help. Again, this is where I meet people where they are. I sometimes meet a person struggling with weight who says, I've been seeing a dietitian my whole life. And I might say, okay, let's pivot and let's not do that. Or again, I might want them to see an exercise physiologist, but I need to pause and address their knee pain. So again, meeting people where they are, but I do lean on a multidisciplinary team to help patients achieve their goals.
That's great. Yeah, and you can essentially quarterback them to the appropriate subject matter expert within that umbrella approach.
That's right. That's right.
One thing that I've come across time and time again with family members and friends and people that I've coached is they're on this weight loss journey. They finally get momentum. It kind of feels like they're going downhill with the rate that they're losing weight, and then all of a sudden they hit a plateau, and maybe they're down 20 pounds over the course of 8 or 12 weeks, and then they get to a week where they gain a pound, or there's 2 weeks in a row where there's no weight loss, but none of their habits changed, at least from what they say, right? They're still doing the routine, they're in rhythm. Is that something that you also see? And if so, like, how do you help people? Because a lot of it is navigating that the shame that immediately comes back. Like they so quickly
I'm
forget
doing
that they
something
just
wrong.
lost 20 pounds and they're like, ah, like they're right back to square one, when in reality, it's like they're not though. They're 20 pounds lighter than they once were. So in this instance, well, number one, do you see this? And then number two, like, how do you help patients navigate that and proceed forward with progress?
Right. Okay. So awesome questions. A lot to unpack there. First of all, when we start a medication as a part of our treatment for weight management, we set some reasonable goals as far as the number on the scale. We have lots of other goals we set that might not be numeric at all, but I do like to explore what the patient's goal is as far as the weight number. And then I talk to them about what the realistic goal weight is. And if we're using a GLP-1 agonist, max benefit from these drugs is 15 to 20% weight loss. Okay. But if my patient's sitting in front of me and really wants to lose 35% of their weight, we pause and say, that's probably not realistic, right? So setting realistic goals is really important. The non-GLP-1 agonist medicines, up to 10%, 8 to 10% weight loss is what we see. So again, setting reasonable goals. Then I tell people you are going to plateau no matter what, right? And the reason being, one, efficacy of our treatment and our medication. Second of all, we talk to people when you lose weight, you cannot preferentially only lose fat, right? And some people want to lose only fat from one part of their body and not from the other. And we can control that too. But in addition to losing fat, you are going to lose some muscle. You might lose some bone, right? So I don't want you to lose too much weight because if you are an older adult that might have some osteopenia or reduced bone density, I don't want you to lose any bone or muscle supporting those bones. But when you lose muscle, in addition to the fat, your metabolism slows down. We talked about muscle being the biggest contributor as far as tissue to our metabolic rate. So especially if someone is not having adequate resistance training, muscle building exercise as they're actively losing weight, when they're down those 20 pounds you spoke of, their metabolism has slowed, right? And now they might be eating the exact same way they did that caused the initial 20-pound weight loss because their metabolism is slower than it was when they were 20 pounds heavier. We're going to plateau. This is normal. This is physiology. In addition, there's been studies done over and over again that show that when we are losing weight, your brain says, what? What's going on? And it wants to protect a certain, we call it weight set point. And your body actually upregulates hunger hormones, when we're actively losing weight, right? Especially if you're someone that's dropping weight very quickly. As we are losing weight, your body's actively releasing hunger hormones. So having that pull, in addition to a slower metabolism, most people will plateau at some point. And again, that is normal. We do have strategies to break through a plateau if we feel we need further weight loss, which is a separate discussion, right? But we normalize it. We say this is normal. And the other thing I talk to patients about, again, obesity is a chronic disease. It is not unusual. In fact, it's pretty common for people to regain weight, right? And what does that mean? It might mean we need to sit down again and reassess everything we're doing. How is our lifestyle? Do we need to modify something further? Did we go through an illness and our sleep was much worse? Right? So we need to regroup. Is our treatment strategy still working? Do we need a new or additional tool, right, to help with weight loss? So again, we normalize and we power through.
How do you navigate a patient who has been on a journey for a long time and they've seen significant weight loss? I'm talking 90 plus pounds of weight loss, and they're nearing a zone where they haven't been in 20, 30 years, and they might not even necessarily be obese anymore. How do you navigate them coming off of, let's call it, say, a GLP-1 agonist, where like the hunger voice that people talk about is being suppressed chemically? Yeah. So how do you help a patient navigate that voice volume coming back on when the drug starts to come out of the picture a little bit?
Well, first thing is, all FDA-approved anti-obesity medicines are approved for lifelong. So I have that conversation before starting medicines, right? People will ask me, do I need to be on this medicine for the rest of my life? And oftentimes I say, maybe not this one. Maybe a different one, maybe a combination of our tools. Maybe when we reach our goals, we can lower the dose or we can take the medicine a little less frequently. But the strategy is usually to maintain whatever course of action helped us lose the weight, right? So I talk to patients about the lowest effective dose of any medication that we're using. But again, I normalize obesity as a chronic disease, and most of my patients do remain on some form of medication for the rest of their lives. And I tell them that again, the landscape of treatment for obesity has exploded, and we know there's going to be new medicines coming out on the market. So are you always going to be on an injectable GLP-1 the rest of your life? Maybe not. But you are most likely, more likely than not, going to be on some form of a medication to help with a chronic disease, right? If someone has asthma and I prescribe them an effective inhaler that helps them not feel short of breath with exercise and not wheeze all the time. If I remove that inhaler, wheezing comes back. We know asthma is a chronic disease. Obesity is no different, right? But again, these internal biases are always there. So I constantly readdress them with patients, and we come up with a sustainable plan.
Great. To close, I have one final question. I'm going to read a statistic
Okay.
to lead into the question. 60% of adults and 31% of children are projected to have overweight or obesity by 2050. That's 25 years from now. Even reading that statistic in real time, it is alarming, right? Like, 2050 feels far away, but 25 years from now doesn't feel so far away. With these statistics out there now, how are you helping patients seek the help that they need, find multidisciplinary care teams, or even, like, what advice do you have for the listeners to be aware of these statistics and take this chronic condition seriously and not wait until it's too late for some individuals?
So a couple of things. The statistics are terrifying, right? We are in a real epidemic in the US as far as overweight and obesity. And we need better healthcare systems to address this, right? It needs to start at the food level and at the quality of food that we're consuming. So better nutrition education in elementary school, early childhood, and going forward, certainly in the medical school setting. Again, better accountability for our food industry and food companies in telling us what nutrients they put in their food and really holding them to higher standards. That is number one, right? Allowing our as many people as possible to move more easily, I think will be really helpful. Better transportation infrastructure and better education around movement, of course, is really important. Better education around sleep is really important. So all those things really, I think we are in a crisis mode when it comes to obesity rates, and we need to act. As far as for people listening to us and watching us and struggling with weight, for one, clearly you're not alone. I think having the GLP-1 medication, bringing new treatment for weight to in everyone's space, right, really allows the topic to be much more commonplace. And I really encourage you to talk to your doctors about it, right? Your doctor is really to support you in any health goal that you have. And although it's not an easy topic to bring up, as we talked about, there's lots of shame and guilt. You need to be your own advocate and you need to ask for help. And if you feel that your doctor is not supportive enough in this process, or you feel like maybe your doctor is not empowered enough with the information, again, I spoke a little bit about that medical training, unfortunately, is really inadequate when it comes to obesity care. Then you need to seek an expert, right? The Obesity Medicine Association has a searchable field on the website where you can search for a board-certified obesity medicine expert in your area. And but I would start with your own family or primary care doctor and bring up the topic and open the conversation, advocate for yourself. Again, we know that weight management is the ultimate preventative strategy to live a longer and healthier life. So bring it up. And if you don't feel heard or seen, consult an expert in the area.
Great. Dr. Alperin, thank you for a tremendous amount of value today. That's it for the Educated Patient podcast. Stay informed, stay empowered. And if you want more information on this topic or other conditions, please visit theeducatedpatient.com.